This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We thought tuberculosis had been contained in America. It was, but it isn't anymore. TB has been on the rise since the mid-80s. In some poor areas of America, the TB rates are higher than those of the poorest countries in the world. A contagious disease like tuberculosis is everyone's problem. So we called Dr. Barry Bloom to find out why TB is on the rise and who is most at risk. Bloom is the former chair of the World Health Organization's TB Committee. He retired from the position in April after serving for 6 years. He's also a professor of microbiology and immunology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. TB is a bacterial disease that affects the lungs. Symptoms include persistent coughing, fever, and weight loss. The disease can be deadly if untreated or if the bacteria is resistant to antibiotics. Dr. Bloom told me there are several reasons behind today's tuberculosis epidemic.
I think one has to throw in three reasons. The first is clearly the increase in AIDS. Many people were infected with TB, but only a few developed disease. But when the HIV virus wears down the immune system, then one becomes very vulnerable to tuberculosis. I think the second reason is that there has been a decay in the social structures in the major cities in the United States. Along with the epidemic of AIDS, we have even preceding it. Homelessness, loss of funds for public health resources and social resources in the cities. So we have lots of people crowded into relatively unsanitary circumstances. And then the third reason is the decline in governmental support to maintain public health structures. And public health is designed to prevent diseases. And we're so used to paying to treat diseases once they already happen. We've sometimes forgotten the importance of, and certainly the cost benefits, of preventing people from getting sick. And that requires a public health system with public health nurses and doctors treating people, vaccinating people, providing drugs early on in illness to prevent people from getting sick.
How bad is the epidemic now?
The epidemic, the history of tuberculosis is that TB has declined in the United States for over 70 years, till 1985. And then the curve started to go up, such that there is an excess of about 26,000 cases that has occurred since 1985. And so the curve should have declined as people infected as children age and turn over. But the curve is actually going up. And we believe that that means that there is new transmission of infection within the cities, and more people are being infected than they would have been had we had good treatment and good control of the disease.
Yeah, you've said that the epidemic is a predictable result of abandoning public health measures. What public health measures did we have that we've since abandoned?
We had a system of grants from the federal government, for example, through the Centers for Disease Control, to the states and the cities for maintaining personnel whose job it was to identify people that had or could have tuberculosis, to go into schools and do skin testing of children, to take people who look like they were infected, and you know that when a skin test becomes positive, and provide a very simple drug that prevents disease about 90% of the time. That disappeared in the early 70s. And so the failure of those resources to maintain a team of people who were expert in how to identify the disease, how to find it, how to motivate people to take their preventive therapy, and how to treat it to prevent transmission, fell out in some but not all cities.
Why was that money cut back in the early 70s?
I think it was part of the great retrenchment of federal funds that had been given away to the states for social services and for health purposes. And this was the sense that we wanted to privatize things. And one of the things that's very difficult to privatize is preventing disease because the real resources turn over in treating disease. And that really, one has to look then, whose role is it to provide preventive programs, education programs in schools to keep kids from getting sick from common illnesses, preventive programs to stop the transmission of infectious diseases, vaccine programs to prevent the 28,000 cases of measles we had in the United States in 1990. And I believe that that can only be the public health system. People pay when they're sick to have themselves treated and made better. It's the public sector, the government requirement, whose job it is to pay for all of us to keep us from getting sick.
And I guess part of the reason why there's a public responsibility for that is if one person gets sick, they spread it to other people, and that's how an epidemic is started.
And that's basically what makes tuberculosis different than many other diseases. If you have a heart condition and don't wish to comply with treatment, the only person really, besides your family members, that you put at risk, and the only person at medical risk, is yourself. Tuberculosis is a highly infectious disease. And it's of the most dangerous kind because it's transmitted by droplets from coughing, sneezing, or even talking. I like to say that when you ask what is the major risk factor for tuberculosis, the major risk factor is breathing, and there's not much we can do to obliterate that. Consequently, the most important thing in TB is to find people who have the disease at an early stage and treat them properly. And within 2 weeks to a month, they cease to be infectious and they can no longer transmit the disease. And the fact that we believe there is active transmission going on means there are lots of people who have the disease and are not picked up, have nowhere to go, may not even know they have it, and are not being treated or forced to maintain their treatment so that they can be cured.
Is this different from the way it used to be when there were tuberculosis epidemics? Are we having more trouble finding and treating people who have it and are spreading it?
Yes and no. We had in the old days no tools, no drugs to cure anybody of TB or prevent TB. And in fact, what we had was the necessity to have sanatoria where people mostly voluntarily, in fact, went and became isolated from society, which had a huge public health impact, which is it minimized the transmission of disease. And then either one lived or died, and the percentage of survival, so-called case fatality rate, of untreated tuberculosis in the United States or anywhere else in the world is about 50%. So half the people made it on their own by virtue of their own immunity, and the other 50% simply died. The difference now is that we have, or up until very recently with the emergence of multi-drug resistant strains, we have very good drugs for TB. The cure rates for TB for people who take those drugs appropriately is about 95 to 98% in the United States. And I should add, that case cure rate is about the same whether you're HIV positive or not. So the key thing to prevent transmission and to cure the disease is make sure people get those drugs, but more importantly, take them for a period of 6 to 9 months. And that's where the real problem has come in. It's very difficult when someone feels better after taking drugs for a month to encourage them or persuade them that they should take 3 drugs, many capsules and pills, over a 6 or 9 month period. And when they start to feel good, they stop taking their pills. And that's the new dimension that has been added to the current situation. Not only do they relapse again after 3 or 6 months with active TB, not only do they spread the disease, but as they go on and off the medication, it's a perfect scenario for selecting for drug-resistant tuberculosis. So that if you look at the isolates, for example, of TB bacilli in New York City last year, 1 out of 3 was resistant to 1 or more antibiotics. And when they get resistant to 2, we really don't have nearly so good backup or second-line drugs. It becomes a major problem. And when they become resistant to 5 or 6, the case fatality rate is about the same as it is in totally untreated disease. 50% die.
So in other words, people who don't really understand antibiotics and who aren't seeing a doctor regularly, by not taking their medicine after the symptoms disappear, they're breeding a more resistant version of tuberculosis.
That's absolutely correct. And had they taken their pills, these organisms would not have existed.
So now what's the challenge to medical professionals now to try to get the drugs to people and to convince them to take it?
The challenge is enormous. The challenge is, at the first level, to make access to those drugs available to everybody. For example, in New York City, which really does have an epidemic, if a third of the samples are resistant to one of the major drugs, and if you have 4,000 new cases, or almost that, last year in New York, how do you make sure, for example, that a working person has access to a city clinic that can get those drugs? There is no clinic in New York City open after 5 o'clock at night, and the waits are often very long. That's not a scenario to encourage people to come get their drugs and take them for 6 months. There are many people who are homeless, who live in shelters, who are on the street, who have barely enough to survive on and barely enough to eat. Not easy to tell them to eat pills instead of food. So the challenge really is to make it possible to reach those people and provide an incentive for them to want to continue the course of treatment. The incentive to the system is very clear, not only to cure the individual case, but to prevent the much greater costs as those infections are transmitted from non-compliant patients to the normal population.
What kind of incentives are possible to provide people to get them to take their drugs?
We don't really know. In Denver, there were wonderful studies that if you simply provided coffee and food, donuts, breakfast, lunches, people came with a 90% regularity who had failed and repeatedly failed taking their drugs over time. And so there is some reason to believe that reaching people would solve part of the problem. And for those that really need more than that, incentives would provide for another part of the problem. But I have to say, we all recognize that there is a very small segment that is simply unlikely, once they feel well, to continue taking their medicine. And that poses major social and ethical issues to everybody.
What kinds of issues?
There is a possibility in most states that people who are infectious represent a threat to the public health. And there are laws on the books of most states that say they can be detained, often against their will, if the Department of Health or the legal advisory bodies believe that's necessary. Nobody likes forced detention. Nobody likes to force people to take their medication. But the threat to the public health versus the civil liberties of an individual is a major issue that is being debated all across the country in medical circles concerned with TB.
Well, I know with AIDS, the issue came up earlier in the epidemic. Should people who have AIDS be quarantined? Is the issue of quarantine coming up with tuberculosis?
Yes and no. The first point is, I think that was a silly issue. There has, if you look historically at quarantine in the United States, even for infections coming in from overseas, they never worked. So quarantine as a public health measure is more a political face-saving measure than it is an epidemiologically effective measure. What one does with patients, any patients with active tuberculosis, first and foremost, if they come for treatment, is to put them in a circumstance where they cannot transmit the disease to anyone else. That means two things. One is a medical facility which is called respiratory isolation or containment, a facility in which they are in a closed environment, preferably ventilated, possibly with germs that can be killed by UV lights, such that they can't infect the medical personnel, the nursing personnel, the prison personnel, or their fellow patients, perhaps most importantly. And that is not quarantine. That is good medical practice. If drugs are given, then usually within a couple weeks, they cease to be infectious and then do not have to stay for the remainder of their 6 months in any kind of medical facility, provided that they are willing and able to take their drugs on a regular basis.
Dr. Barry Bloom is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Barry Bloom. He chaired the Tuberculosis Committee for the World Health Organization for 6 years. He's also a professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. I just want to clarify something before we go any further, and that is, how easy is it to contract tuberculosis from somebody who has it? I mean, if you walk past somebody who's coughing and has tuberculosis, does that mean you're likely to get it?
It's the favorite question that everyone always asks. It's usually formulated in, can I catch TB from riding the bus? And one of the curiosities of TB is that it's very unpredictable. We know it's transmitted in small droplet nuclei, tiny things that float around in the air and don't settle out. So, in fact, there is a real possibility for anybody who is in the same airspace with a patient with tuberculosis to catch TB. The likelihood really is not very great for most people in public transport or any circumstance where there's ventilation. One of the important things the sanatoria did is they, for perhaps crazy reasons, thought that fresh air was beneficial and decided to open all the windows, even in the very northern parts of New York State. That opening of the windows, forget the cold air and the fresh air, ventilated out those air droplets, and it's a very good way of diluting them such that they become very unlikely to infect. On the other hand, there is the circumstance of a school in St. Louis you may have read about in the newspapers in 1990, where a single teacher who did not have HIV disease infected 175 elementary school students. That's more than half of the entire students in the school. Didn't know he had tuberculosis, thought he had a smoker's cough. So its problems with the risks are that they're unpredictable.
Now, I know you just got back from visiting Rikers Island Prison.
I did.
In New York. What were you looking for there?
Clearly, prisons are one of those places where people are in very close contact, and the people who are taken into prisons are people who one knows very little about their medical experience or history. So there's a terrifically high risk that some of them may be infected with TB or doubly infected with TB and HIV and possibly have active disease. And there have been notable outbreaks. One a couple months ago just outside of Washington where over 100 prisoners were infected with tuberculosis from a single active patient who was not picked up. I must say that the activity at Rikers Island Prison, which is just next to LaGuardia Airport in New York, has been really remarkable. The problem was recognized as a potential disaster immediately. A high number of the prisoners there are HIV positive, and the consequences of their being infected with TB is almost 100% fatal unless treated adequately. So a brand new disease control unit, state-of-the-art, has just opened. It was built in 90 days under court order, where patients have rooms with very good filtered ventilation, each a separate room, each a telephone, and each a television set. So this is hardly quarantine in the sense that you would have used it in the past. And they have double doors that protect the hospital workers, but still enable the people to be examined and treated until they are no longer infectious. And then they can be continued to be treated, but in a regular prison facility. As of the moment it opened in June, my understanding is that the men's facility, they no longer even have enough units for all the patients that are demanding such facilities.
What kind of health leadership do you think we need right now?
Well, I think if I am not really qualified to make general statements politically, but my sense is after the election of Senator Wofford from Pennsylvania on a campaign that said personal security in the area of health is perhaps as or more important than national security, has really, and the high cost of medical care and the high cost of government contributions to medical care, I hope have put the issue of health on the agenda. Our public health in this country is really remarkably poor given the wealth of this country. I cite one other example, not TB. In Vietnam, in Uganda, in Tanzania, in Salvador, over 80% of the kids under the age of 2 receive their childhood vaccines. In Houston, Texas, that number is 15%. In the Bronx in New York, where I work, that number is 35%. There is nothing cheaper in preventing disease and death in the entire world than giving childhood vaccinations. And the fact that we cannot mobilize the resources to do that is a tremendous indictment of the priorities in this country.
Are we falling behind third world countries in our health care?
Behind third world countries. Let me give you another figure. Mozambique, Malawi, Benin, Nicaragua have tuberculosis control programs in which not only do over 80 to 85% of the patients complete treatment, but they are cured after follow-up for 2 years. In the United States of America, we do not have any data on follow-up. We do have data on case completion rates, that is, the ability of people to take 6 months' worth of drugs in the major cities. Some cities do very well, over 90%. Overall, many cities, including New York, do very poorly, on the order of 50%. Perhaps most tragic and most pinpointing the threat to communities is in a study of 224 consecutive patients at Harlem Hospital who had tuberculosis. After 6 months, only 11% had taken their medication and had completed treatment. That means 89% of those people left capable of spreading the disease and probably developing drug resistance. That's the tragedy of the major cities in this country.
What do you see when you look ahead?
I always see hope when I look ahead, and the sense that maybe the only way to prove that it pays to invest in preventing disease is to add up the costs of having that disease. So we've been working with two economists, one from New York, one from Harvard, to try to calculate the costs of not doing TB right. That is, had we done it right, the curve of TB would continue to go down for the last 70 years to a very low level, and we would eliminate it, basically, as a public health problem. But that increment, that excess cases of 26,000 people, that has a cost. That costs in drugs, that costs $1,000 a day in New York for hospitalization. And those costs, by the end of the decade, as it stands now, are going to add up to billions of dollars. We know that already. Not counting the infrastructure, the $62 million to build a prison here and a prison here and a prison here and a long-term care facility here, there, and elsewhere. We're going to be paying many, many billions of dollars. And maybe it will register that it would have been a lot cheaper to have had a good public health infrastructure and not have the money go in and out with each fashion. Diseases don't go in and out of fashion unless we make them so.
Well, Dr. Bloom, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. Barry Bloom is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.